I'm turning now to the first book of Samuel, chapter 27 and verse 6. 1 Samuel, chapter 27, verse 6. Then Achish gave him, David, Ziklag that day. Wherefore Ziklag pertaineth unto the kings of Judah unto this day. And the time that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was a full year and 4 months. And our subject is in the land of the Philistines. Now, David, after his depression, and you read about that in the first verse of chapter 27, David said in his heart, spoke to himself, I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape into the land of the Philistines, so that Saul would leave off from pursuing him. So he goes to Achish, the king of Gath, the first lord of the Philistines, and the only one of the lords of the Philistines who is described as a king. It is the second time that David has gone to Gath. He obviously was hopeful of a good reception from Achish, the king of Gath, even though he was an enemy of Israel. So he went there. The previous time, well, we studied that. It was a catastrophe for David, and he had to suffer great humiliation in order to escape. And yet he returns in his time of spiritual depression. While he's there, 1 year, 4 months, he busies himself. He's sent away by Achish, king of Gath, to Ziklag in the south at a considerable distance. And while there, he busies himself by dealing with various Amalekite and Philistine groups in the desert, in the wilderness, who attacked Israel, who formed marauding bands. And he dealt with them and their cities and raided them. And of course, this greatly pleased the people of Israel. But it mustn't be known to the first lord of the Philistines, the king of Gath, who was his host. And so David deals very cruelly with the people he defeats and deals with, and executes everyone. He's in the land of the Philistines. He's in great doubt of God's care for him. That's why he's there. He has previously trusted God, apart from one time when he fell away from that trust. He believed the promise of God that he would take care of him. He'd had amazing demonstrations of God's deliverance of him. And yet his faith seems to collapse. And so he goes back into the land of the Philistines. And while there, well, he still persuades himself that he's for Israel and he's the Lord's. So he leads these excursions into enemy territory. But it's a strange business, because it has to be done dishonestly, and there has to be concealment from his host. So while he's in the land of the Philistines, even though he may persuade himself he can go on serving the Lord, it's something that can only be done in a somewhat underhanded manner. And he remains in the land of the Philistines, not trusting his God and escaping the wrath of Saul by being there. Achish must never know. And this is so similar to us as Christians. The life of David reflects us in our ups and downs in many ways. Times of spiritual coldness. Maybe we won't for the moment call it backsliding. Maybe it isn't full-blown backsliding. We continue with some minor avenue of service for the Lord, albeit coldly, because we're in the land of the Philistines. We're not committed. We're not attending worship as we did, perhaps only minimally. We are not engaged in prayer privately as we used to be. We're in the land of the Philistines. We convince ourselves that we're still the Lord's. We do something, but our main disposition is that we're in the land of the Philistines. Maybe we're consumed by our business life, career prospects, work, and so on, and nothing like the same degree of ardour and commitment and enthusiasm goes into worship and the Lord's work anymore. We are absent in heart, if not in body, and perhaps very largely in body too, distracted, maybe distracted by completely worldly things, television or whatever, and our programs and self-discipline have gone to pieces, so there isn't prayer, and there isn't zeal, and there isn't really heartfelt service for the Lord. Well, that was the position of David, and his being in the land of the Philistines, where he could not prove the Lord, is paralleled by us so very often. Well, we come down to chapter 28, and normal hostilities are resumed as far as the Philistines are concerned. It came to pass in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for warfare to fight with Israel. And Achish said to David, now he's sent for him, and he's made the journey from Ziklag to Gath. And Achish said unto David, know thou assuredly that thou shalt go up with me to battle, thou and thy men. So now Achish wants David's entire loyalty. He wants his presence. He wants him and his men to take part in this great battle. And that reflects the way of the world too. When we're one foot in the world and one foot in the kingdom of God, very soon the world wants all of us. And some great enticement or some terrible temptation will come along, and we shall be spiritually weak and enfeebled, and we'll collapse. Now David is in this terrible position. He cannot continue now in the land of the Philistines, but at a distance from Gath, doing one thing, doing two opposite things at once. And verse 2, David said unto Achish, surely thou shalt know what thy servant can do. Sounds awful, but I don't think it's genuine. There's a lump in his throat, even as he speaks. He almost chokes these words. Inwardly, he must be desperately hoping that God will intervene and he'll never be put to this, enrolled entirely into the service of the Philistines. And Achish says to David, therefore will I make thee keeper of mine head forever. He has a strange attachment to David, and he wants, he's half promising him some position of great closeness to the king of Gath, the first lord of the Philistines. What an impossible position for David, anointed to be king of Israel, commissioned by God to be Israel's deliverer from the hand of the Philistines, and now about to be part of the Philistine army offensive. Well, from verse 3, we covered this in a previous study. We read about Saul in the meantime and his encounter with the witch or the medium of Endor, and how he disguised himself and went to her, and how Samuel appeared in some shape or form and delivered to him what he'd heard previously but never taken seriously, the condemnation of God of his reign and the sentence that he would be defeated in battle, so that the whole heart and spirit goes out of him. But I want to come down now from Saul's doom to chapter 29 and verses 1 to 2. It's deliberation. God is going to deliver him, but there's going to be a test, a probationary period for him. So verses 1 and 2 of chapter 29. Now the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek. That's about 50 miles from Ziklag. And David and his company had to make that route march up his 600 men from Ziklag. It's said that it would have taken them anything from 3 to 4 days. Verse 2, and the lords of the Philistines passed on by hundreds and by thousands. It was an enormous force that was raised. And David and his 600 men passed on in the rear with Achish. And then we read verse 3, God's intervention. The princes of the Philistines demanded, what do these Hebrews here? And Achish spoke his mind. This is David, servant of Saul, king of Israel. He's been with me these days or these years. 1 year and 4 months, we read earlier. And I've found no fault in him since he fell unto me this day. And the princes of the Philistines were wroth with him, and they demanded that he would go over these verses from verse 4 and so on. So Achish has to yield to his princes. And he explains to David, verse 6. And there's a tremendous phrase in verse 6. Then Achish called David and said unto him, surely as the Lord liveth. What's this? The chief lord of the Philistines, the king of Gath, Achish, using Israel's language. He's a polytheist. As the Lord liveth. And he utters the divine name of the Israelites, expressed in capital letters here, the word Lord. As the Lord liveth. So Achish, is he being ultra polite to David to use the name of his God? Or is he sincere? Why, as you look at Achish, he seems to be half a Christian, so to speak, half an Israelite. But half a believer is still a Philistine. Half a believer, don't let's be over-impressed, he's still going to lead tens and thousands against Israel to decimate the Lord's people. And that's an application for us today. Sometimes there are people, they're not converted, and they seem to be halfway there, and they'll use spiritual language and so on, but they're still worldlings. Be careful. They're still really on the other side, deep down. And so it was with Achish. So he demands, verse 7, that David returns. David, verse 8, says unto Achish, but what have I done? I think David is still trying to protect himself. He must inwardly be so relieved that he's being turfed out and sent home. But he wants the goodwill of Achish to get out of the city, as it were. And Achish answered, verse 9, said to David, I know that thou art good in my sight, and as an angel of God. Well, he hadn't been. But he demands, he rises early and goes, and down to verse 11, David and his men rose up early to depart in the morning. But here's the test. The problem is going to be solved. David entangled with the Philistines. They turf him out, and in good grace, and he travels the 50 miles back to Ziklag. And it came to pass, when David and his men were come to Ziklag, on the third day that the Amalekites had invaded the south. This is not the Philistines themselves, it's Amalekites. And Ziklag also they'd invaded, and smitten Ziklag, and burned it with fire. And those 600 men with David, they arrive, and they see a great column of smoke, and the city is smouldering, and the houses are ash, and the people have all been taken, presumably to serve the Amalekites, or to be sold on into slavery. They'd taken the women captives, they'd taken David's two wives, taken the sons and the daughters, and verse 4 of chapter 30, David and the people that were with him lifted up their voice and wept until they had no more power to weep. There is such sorrow. What a test this is going to be, and what a problem. Verse 5, David's wives, their loss is noted. Verse 6, and David was greatly distressed. Now that word distressed translates a Hebrew word which means David was greatly bound. What it means is he was hemmed in on all sides, as if bound. He didn't know what to do. He's just had a tremendous relief, release from an awful problem. And now his situation is suddenly just as bad. Everything he had has been taken, but the wives, the families, leaving just a smoking, ruined city. So David was hemmed in on every side. What do I do? The verse says, verse 6, the people spake of stoning him. They turned against him. He's the cause of their troubles. They wanted him dead. Well, before, up until this time, David and his 600 have always been delivered. Every problem, there's been a remarkable delivery. This is something entirely new for the 600. From being delivered from everything, they've now lost everything, and their families. And they turned against David, because the soul of all the people was grieved. And the Hebrew word is bitter. They were bitter and resentful against him. Every man for his sons and for his daughters. The great test, David back to being hemmed in on every side. Whatever will he do? And the end of verse 6, but David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. Now, in a superficial reading, it sounds almost callous. How can David encourage himself when all his people have lost their families and their everything? He doesn't read very well. However, it's very important. Encouraged himself. The Hebrew is the word strengthened. David strengthened himself. And it says, in the Lord his God. Now, many of the modern translations mishandle this, and they say, David received strength from the Lord his God, which sounds much more reasonable. But no, our King James Version, in common with all the older versions, has got it absolutely right. David encouraged or strengthened himself in the Lord his God. He followed a procedure. Of course, we need the help of the Lord. That's obvious. But the in is important here. It shows that David did something. He strengthened himself in the Lord his God. He followed a set procedure. It means something like this. He encouraged himself by switching his mind to the mighty power of God. He encouraged himself by remembering his great deliverances that God had given him. Way back when he served his father from the lion and the bear, back to the day when he brought about by the power of God the fall of Goliath, back to the deliverances he'd had from Saul's murderous efforts. He encouraged himself in the Lord. He thought, he reflected, he took hold of his mind and, as it were, pulled himself together. And to get the help of God, he not only asked for it, but he strengthened himself in the Lord, reflecting on God's mighty patience with him, the deliverance he'd just had from serving in the army of the Philistines, and he rededicated himself to the Lord. So there's nothing callous about this. David went on his knees and he followed the procedure for strengthening and rededicating himself in the Lord. And we learn from that. And what follows in verse 7, David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, I pray thee, bring me hither the ephod. Now this is interesting. The priest, the acting high priest, and the ephod, the means of seeking the guidance of God through the high priest, had been with David all the time. It had clearly been on the journey to see the king of Gath, 50 miles. It had been obviously on the return journey, 50 miles back. It was still with David. And you ask yourself, why hadn't David consulted it up until this point? But it's fairly clear he hadn't done. And only now that he strengthened himself in the Lord does he seek the guidance of God. And he asks the Lord, shall I pursue? It's a big question. After all, this Amalekite band is enormous. It isn't 100 or 200 or 300 marauding people, Amalekites. There are at least 2,000 or 3,000 of them. I'll show you how we know that in the following verses. And he only had 600 men. Only 400 of them were any good. The others got old men, I imagine, who got tired very quickly. Don't forget they were all malcontents, not crack soldiers. And that's all he had. So he asks the Lord, shall I pursue? And the answer of the Lord to the ephod and the priest, pursue, and you'll take them, and you'll repossess all that they've removed. So it's the first time. In other words, the priest, the acting high priest, and the ephod, the means of grace, had been near him all the time, 1 year and 4 months. And only now do we read he consults them. That's back to our periods of spiritual coldness. The Lord is near, but we're not consulting him. We're not depending upon him. It's only now that David gets a mighty deliverance, but it's on probation and a big test that he consults the Lord. That's in verse 8. For thou shalt surely overtake them and without fail recover all. So David went, he and the 600 men, and they came to the brook Besor, where those that were left behind stayed. They couldn't go any further. The 50 miles to northwards to the king of Gath, and the return journey had evidently put paid to them. They were so faint that they could not go over the brook Besor. Well, that was only one problem. But David's now trusting the Lord again. He's got the assurance of God. I will go with 400 men and confront this mighty force. Problem number two, it's in verse 11. It's a big test, this. And they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David and gave him bread, and he did eat, and they made him drink water. Why did they bring him to David? They found a young Egyptian in the field. So what? Well, you see, they didn't know how to pursue this troop. The verses that follow give us a clear indication, though they don't state it explicitly, that they were rather lost as to which way this great host had gone. Although there were many of them, perhaps they took more than one route to where they were heading. But they were confused, and the verses show they were lost with regard to pursuing and following this great host. But an act of compassion solves the problem, and great good comes out of reviving the life of an Egyptian they just happened to find. And it even gives the details, a cake of figs, two clusters of raisins, and so on. But the man kind of came to, and David said unto him, "Who do you belong to? Where do you come from?" "I am a young man of Egypt," verse 13, "servant to an Amalekite," who he seems to be terrified of. He's got two problems. A little later, he says to David, "If I show you where they stay, don't kill me and don't give me back to my master," almost as though they're equal fates. "I am a young man of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite, and my master left me because 3 days agone I fell sick." And then he says, "We invaded the south, the Kerethites, and the coast of Judah, and the south of Calob, and we burned Ziklag with fire." David said, "Canst thou bring me down to this company?" He asks for his life, and then he leads them. He knows the route he'd come from, and he can find the way back. And then the provision of God, verse 16, "When he had brought him down with his mere 400 men, behold, they were spread abroad upon all the earth. Many of them dead drunk on the ground, evidently, others still eating and drinking and dancing and half tipsy because of all the great spoil that they had taken out of the land of the Philistines and out of the land of Judah." Look at verse 17. "David smote them from the twilight even unto the evening of the next day." It was an enormous number of them. "And there escaped not a man of them, except 400 young men on camels who managed to flee." And that's spoken of as though it's a minority. So however many were there? Several thousand at least. What a provision that they'd started to celebrate and got themselves drunk and quite incapacitated, unable to defend themselves. And David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away. He recovered his wives, and there was nothing lacking to them. But then look what happens. They recovered all. And don't forget, this is the spoil that was taken from Philistines and from Judeans. "And David took all the flocks," verse 20, "and the herds, which they drave before those other cattle." Tremendous amount of spoil. "And they said," and this is significant, "this is David's spoil." What a turnaround. A short while ago, the they're going to end his life. Now they're so proud of him. This is David's spoil. It's the old David. Of course, he's back with the Lord. And David responds perfectly. There's an incident there which shows that many of his men were really quite wicked people, because they don't want anything to be given to the 200 who were too faint to join the pursuit. And David says in verse 23, 2, very significant verse, David answered all the wicked men and men of Belial, a way of saying worthless men, of those that went with David, and said, because they went not with us, we will not give them aught of the spoil that we have recovered, so the wicked said. Then David said, ye shall not do so, my brethren, with that which the Lord hath given us. They said, it's David's spoil. He said, it's the Lord's spoil. He has given it to us and delivered the company that came against us into our hand. 2 points here. David made it a statute in Israel. The people who are too weak to fight, who are left at home, in camp, looking after things, are as worthy of the reward as those who go to the battle. Interpretation for today: the members of the prayer meeting are absolutely equal in every way to the men in the pulpits. That's the principle that was taught even from the time of David. There's no difference at all. We're all one in this because it's the Lord's work. And then David says, verse 23, it's what the Lord has given us. Once again, I was mentioning it in a prayer meeting. These churches, and there are some mega churches, mainly in America, that greatly over-reward their pastors. And their pastors have millionaire homes, and sometimes even multiple homes. And they're rich men. They're fantastically over-rewarded. Where is this spirit of David? It is the Lord's spoil. It's what the Lord has given us. If the Lord builds the church, it's the work of the Holy Spirit of the living God. We always bear that in mind. We keep ourselves down to size. We don't laud and applaud preachers or figureheads. We give all the glory to the Lord. And that should always be our grand principle. And you see it right here. It's David's spoil. Well, almost at an end. And a final heading, just for 1 or 2 minutes. God changes rulers. Look on to chapter 31. The Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled. It's total collapse, a great retreat. Jonathan dies, chapter 31, verse 2, probably struck by an arrow, because it was an arrow in the following verse that injured Saul, King Saul, his father. The archers hit him, and he was sore wounded of the archers. And in verse 4 of chapter 31, Saul asks his armor bearer to kill him. He knows he's dying. All Saul thinks about is his dignity and his honor, and he's terrified of falling into the hands of the Philistines. And so he asks his armor bearer to do something which is totally illegal under the law of Israel, and to take his life. And his armor bearer wouldn't do it. So Saul has to take his own life. And when his armor bearer sees that he's done that, he too takes his life. So Saul died, and his three sons, and his armour bearer, and all his men, as not his army that's referred to, most of them are in retreat, but his immediate bodyguard. And they fled, and so the Israelites in the nearby cities fled. And it came to pass on the morrow, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his three sons fallen. Saul actually had time to get attention and to get himself carried back to Israel, but all the spirit had gone out of him. The Philistines didn't arrive where he had been until the next day. But still, he wanted to end his life. I'm just going to to 2 Samuel for a moment or two. These remarkable words here. Saul is told, rather David is told, of Saul's death. David isn't there. Why isn't he there? Well, he's gone all the way to Ziklag. He's pursued the invaders of Ziklag for 2 or 3 days. He's returned to Ziklag, and it all takes time. And now he hears of the death of Saul. And verse 2, as a man arrives, and David says to him, "From whence comest thou?" Verse 3, he says, "Out of the camp of Israel am I escaped." And David says, "How went the matter?" Verse 4, he says, "We've lost. The people have fled, and Saul and Jonathan are dead also." And David asks the young man, who turns out to be an Amalekite, "How do you know that Saul and Jonathan are dead?" And then follows a most elaborate story from the young man. It's a lie, it's a fabrication, it's a lot of nonsense, and he tells it because he's got the certain treasures off King Saul's body. He managed to get across the battlefield before the Philistines came. He's an Amalekite corpse raider, and he stripped any valuables off the corpses of the Israelites, and he has stripped the body of Saul. And now he comes down to David, and he hopes for a great reward. And he hopes for a double reward by making up a story that he ended the life of Saul. A Saul called out to him, "Kill me, kill me," and he did so. But of course, he's telling David that he's killed the anointed of the Lord. And David takes what he's got and orders him to be executed, judging him out of his own mouth, when he was just telling a yarn for personal gain. And that's how the kingship changes from Saul to David. But there's just one thing I wanted to mention in closing here, and that is the song that David sings, and that is his lament over Saul and Jonathan. Look at verse 17 of 2 Kings chapter 1. David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. Now look, there's a bracket, verse 18. And in that bracket, "Also he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher." That's not inspired scripture. That's a record that they had in those days of the conflicts of Israel. The bracket is closed, and then the song begins. Now this parenthesis, this bracket, so disturbs modern translators for most of the modern versions that they've rendered it rather differently. And if you read most modern translations, it reads something like this, that David taught them to teach the children the song of the bow, as though that is the title of the lamentation for Saul and Jonathan. Of course, Jonathan's bow, he was very good with the bow, is mentioned further down in the passage. Is it the song of the bow? Or are the old translations right in putting verse 18 in brackets and saying, also David bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow? Which is right? Well, I won't go into the technical things, but I'm quite sure the old translators are right. And I'll tell you why they're right. Because it was because Israel had neglected the bow, among other reasons, that they lost this battle. Of course, they lost the battle because God determined they should, as a punishment, because Saul's life was going to be ended and the people were going to be punished for their sin. However, from a practical side, the big problem was the vast superiority the Philistines had with archers. Long before the opposing armies actually met and engaged in spear and sword fighting, the archers of the Philistines had picked off Jonathan and wounded Saul, and the other sons of Saul were dead, and many others had been killed too, and there was no returning fire. Jonathan was an expert archer, but the provision of archers had been greatly neglected in Israel, and they had no similar opposing force. And David makes it a statute, this will never happen again. We've had bad rule here. We educate the young with archery. And not only do I think that's the right way of rendering the passage, but it gives us a very special pastoral point too. We've been hearing about failures, David's failures, Israel's failure, Saul's failure, and David picks out one of the major reasons for failure, no archers, and he remedies the situation. Have you or I had a period of spiritual coldness? A sin that has set us back? Something which has caused us to stumble or fall? The last lesson for tonight is this. Learn the reason for the failure. Note it and say, this will not happen again. Lord, help me. Ask the question, why did I fall? Why did I fall? Why did you fall? Was your television screen too big? And it enticed you. And it led to a fall. And your self-discipline went. And your prayer went. Has self-discipline been left off? Don't just ask God for forgiveness. Restore the self-discipline, the timetable for spiritual things. Has your concern for souls faded? Put it right. By the help of God. Has your witness faded? What do you think is the cause of the stumble or the fall? Has your appreciation for your husband wavered? Or your appreciation for your wife? And Satan has got in with foul images or something awful? Ask, why did I fall? That's why I think the King James Version has got this right. And David sought to remedy the situation, even though in this case it was a long-term thing. That's enough for us tonight. Lessons in faith from the life of David.